please.
Cast.
Hello and welcome to another edition of Ghost Radio, your guide to the nightly guide to the supernatural with me, John Pilchard. Well, tonight our main guest will be top TV medium Brenda Spadger, and she'll be talking to us about her new book, I Married a Poltergeist, which chronicles her sometimes turbulent marriage to the notorious Wrexham Poltergeist. Ah, right. So, Brenda, perhaps you could start by telling us a little bit about him, how you met your poltergeist husband.
Well, John, I first met him when I was called in to investigate the haunting of the Regal Bingo Hall in Wrexham. And I tell you, when I first met him there, he was so sweet. The way he possessed the bingo caller to recite romantic, albeit expletive-strewn poetry to me. That raspy voice he used was so sexy. The shower of bingo balls which formed into a heart was another lovely touch. How could I resist such a romantic soul?
Indeed, and I believe he continued his courtship through the use of electronic voice phenomena. I mean, most specifically that he would communicate through recorded voices which would spontaneously appear on cassette tapes.
That's right. I put Phil Collins on the tape deck as I drove home and instead hear this gravelly voice whispering about what he'd like to do to me when we got home. I frequently had to pull the car off the road. It made me go so weak at the knees.
Yes, and of course he eventually moved in with you and promised to haunt you exclusively. Isn't that right?
Oh yes, I really thought we'd be together forever, in this world and the next. But he changed. When I wouldn't give him what he wanted, he started going astray himself, haunting other women. I know that he's the phantom bottom pincher who caused mayhem in that girls' school in Chester, not to mention the invisible groper of East Grinstead. I'm not stupid.
Hi, I'm Susie Slees with the latest Halloween news. There are fears that Islamic extremists are targeting this year's Halloween to launch a new series of terror attacks by disguising themselves as trick-or-treaters. Already one man in Luton has fallen victim to the so-called hijab Halloween. I just thought they were the usual little bastards trick-or-treating, but when I told them to bugger off, the one dressed in Islamic gear shouted trick, and exploded, says Luton householder Greg Frigger from his hospital bed, where he is being treated for third-degree burns. The blast was so powerful it blew the front door right off of its hinges and knocked me into the kitchen. My porch was wrecked and there were car alarms going off all down the street. Little did 47-year-old Frigger suspect when he answered the door that fateful night, that he was about to become the first victim of a new wave of terror attacks. I must admit that I was a bit surprised to see someone in that Islamic clobber amongst all the vampires and ghouls, but you see kids dressed in all sorts for Halloween these days, he says. Usually the worst you get from the little gits is having eggs thrown at the house. The attack on Frigger coincided with news that this year's best-selling Halloween costume is the Islamic full hijab, an all-black outfit revealing only the wearer's eyes. It easily outsold traditional favorites like Frankenstein's monster, Dracula, the Wolfman, and that old standby, the Abu Hamza mask and novelty hook hand. It shouldn't really come as surprise, opines Professor Bob Mincer of the Streatham Institute of Remedial Studies. Those crazy Islamic bastards are the biggest bogeymen around these days. Hell, if I opened my door on Halloween to find a bunch of menacing-looking veiled figures clad from head to foot in black, I'd be shitting myself. Industry insiders gleefully admit that the continuing war on terror and the consequent demonization of Muslims has boosted sales. Whilst the British tabloid press have dismissed Muslim protests at the costumes, claiming that they are simply a bit of harmless fun, a darker side to the controversy has begun to emerge. Fears have been expressed that, following the trick-or-treat suicide bombing, children wearing such costumes could be mistaken for terrorists and risk being shot by the police. Indeed, one child has already been gunned down by armed officers as he attempted to leap onto a bus in Luton whilst allegedly wearing a niqab. Luckily, he escaped injury due to the fact that, as a result of budgetary restrictions, Bedfordshire's armed response unit is currently only issued with children's cap pistols. It wasn't any bloody Islamic costume he was wearing, he'd cut eye holes in one of my sheets to dress as a ghost, the child's furious mother later told the press. By the time I've finished with the little bastard, he'll wish the sodding police had shot him. The incident has led to calls for the Islamic terror costumes to be withdrawn from sale. At least when kiddies dressed up as werewolves and vampires, we knew that they were safe to roam the streets after dark knocking on strangers' doors, without the threat of being shot, commented Luton councillor Ron Pemwist, unless it was with silver bullets, of course, and let's not forget that attempted staking a couple of years ago. Or when that mob tried to burn those girls dressed as witches at the stake, come to think of it. Police investigating the alleged trick-or-treat suicide bomber, meanwhile, are beginning to question Greg Frigger's account of the incident. A forensic examination of the remnants of Mr. Frigger's porch has revealed no trace of human remains, a spokesperson told a press conference. Whilst it is possible the bomb was so powerful it completely disintegrated the alleged bomber, it seems far more likely that the device was actually just a large firework thrown at the front door. The police are currently linking the attack not to Islamic extremism, but to an incident the previous Halloween, when Mr. Frigger had chased several trick-or-treaters down the street with a chainsaw. We feel that it is entirely possible this was a revenge attack, commented the spokesperson. That's all for now. More Halloween news later.
Welcome to Alarmist News. Tonight, with Halloween approaching, church leaders and child safety groups have issued warnings over the dangers of a new supernatural craze sweeping Britain's youth. Apparently derived from the 90s horror film Candyman, where saying the eponymous character's name five times in front of a mirror made him a beard, with inevitably dire consequences. In a new version of this, Jimmy Savile replaces the Candyman. Saying his name five times out loud will allegedly result in the deceased DJ and sex offender appearing behind you and molesting you. The Reverend Harold Fibula, a Church of England exorcist, spoke to us about this new evil craze earlier today.
Obviously now, we don't believe that this game will actually result in some wizened old sex offender returning from the grave, but it does represent the invoking of evil, and believe me, spiritual evil of this kind is not to be trifled with. Playing these games could easily lead to far worse things.
We've spoken to several young people who claim to have been literally touched by evil after playing the Savile game. 18-year-old Salford student Emily Knuckle, who invoked the dead DJ during a drunken night out with her friends, admits that she had a lucky escape.
Yes, we ended up in this abandoned warehouse and started daring each other to say his name five times. In the end, I was the only one drunk enough to do it. Well, after I spoke his name aloud the first time, a deathly hush fell over the abandoned building, and then this feeling of dread seemed to hang over the place, but I was determined to continue, so I said his name for a second time, and this time, we could all feel an icy chill fill the place, but even that didn't stop me from saying Jimmy Savile aloud a third time.
It was this third utterance of the dread name which has sent Knuckle and a companion screaming from the building.
I swear that his name had barely passed my lips for a third time when the smell of cigar smoke wafted from somewhere behind me. I could feel the hairs on the back of my neck rise as I realised that no one in the group smoked. Despite fear knotting my stomach, I started to say his name for the fourth time. I just about forced out the word Jimmy when we all heard the ghostly jangling of gold jewellery from somewhere in the dark behind us. I just couldn't help myself. I screamed out loud and leapt out of there with the others following close behind.
Knuckle is convinced that had she uttered Savile's name a fifth time, she and her companions might not have lived to tell the tale, fearing that the spectral sex offender could have dragged them all off to his sex dungeon in hell for an eternity of abuse. Others haven't been so lucky.
Come in. You know why I've asked you here?
Well, I only know what the boys in the village have told me, you know. Lonely old man living in this remote castle, you know. You just like a bit of company from now again?
You must convince the villagers that I'm harmless.
Oh, come on, man. You've got dead bodies hanging on gibbets outside, for God's sake. Are you I can't do the impossible.
You're trembling. Are you afraid?
Well, Boris, you're a handsome man, and you know that those high heels and the little off-the-shoulder number you're wearing, they certainly flatter you.
Have some nice hot coffee. It's butternut. Like it?
Jesus Christ! Tastes like shit! I mean, what is it? Oh my God, there's something floating. It is shit, isn't it?
Butternut has found a way of making coffee richer without being bitter.
Yes, by putting shit in it, for God's sake, man. I mean, are you insane?
Butternut has found a way of making coffee richer without being bitter.
I'm sorry, it doesn't matter how many times you say that. It tastes like shit.
Take this.
What? Are you trying to kill me?
Oh, don't worry. I've lots more. Butternut coffee. Regular and instant. Rich, but never bitter.
But as I understand from your book, it was your poltergeist husband's inability to satisfy you physically that forced you eventually into seeking solace elsewhere yourself.
That's the trouble with elementals. Their lack of actual physical presence means that relations are ethereal, to say the least. Apart from a bit of crude groping, the physical side has to be done by proxy. I mean, he was forced to manipulate various sex toys and in order to simulate penetrative sex. But I found his lack of finesse dissatisfying. I mean, he was so rough. He'd sent the bloody things flying through the air and ramming them into my orifices. He wasn't too choosy about what he used either. Kitchen implements, fruit, vegetables, anything which came to hand. I'd be bruised for days afterwards. How I longed for some tenderness and subtlety.
Yes, yes, and isn't it true that whilst you receive little satisfaction from these activities, your husband's expressions of his sexual ecstasies rapidly became a problem?
Oh yes, oh yes. Every time he had an orgasm, the walls would shake and all the light bulbs would explode. One night all the slates fell off the roof with an almighty crash. God knows what the neighbours thought.
And of course your reluctance to participate in these strange relations with your husband obviously became increasingly apparent to him.
Indeed, John. It got to the stage I couldn't bear the touch of his ectoplasm against my skin, and he started to become violent. It was terrible. He hurled things at me, crockery, furniture, even turnips. That is why I didn't dare tell him about the affairs with other spirits I was having, for fear of what he might do to me.
Ah, yes, yes. These other affairs. I mean, there were several, I believe, including most one of the most celebrated was of course the affair you had with the banshee. But I believe that there's been an affair you had with her, but I believe that that didn't end well.
Oh, God, no. At first it was just fine, it was just fun, but then eventually her constant screaming just got on my tits. She had to go. I had her exercised.
Yes, but I believe your husband's particularly upset to hear that you'd had an affair with your spirit guide, Big John, who had apparently been one of his closest friends on the other side. I mean, they'd done purgatory together, hadn't they?
Yes, well, he completely overreacted to that business. I mean, Big John, I mean, who actually is the ghost of 1950s electrician's mate from Birmingham, actually, but my relationship with him didn't actually count as adultery, as there's no actual penetrative sex. I mean, Big John literally entered me in spirit form, took possession of my body, and thoroughly groped it. As it was my own hands doing the groping and bringing me off, it surely only counts as masturbation.
16-year-old Arthur Enkel, an apprentice meatpacker from Dartford, told us of his experience whilst playing the Savile game.
The way I heard it, you didn't have to say his name 5 times in front of a mirror. Instead, you had to say it 5 times in front of the TV. You just had to tune it so there was nothing but static and repeat his name 5 times in front of the set. Well, I got bored when I was on my own one evening, so I decided to give it a go. I mean, at first, I thought nothing had happened. And then, I was amazed to see the static start to form into an image of Jimmy Savile's face. I mean, at this point, I still wasn't scared, just curious. But then I realised that something more sinister was happening. I realised that it wasn't just an image. It was solid.
Horrified, the teenager watched as Savile began to climb out of the screen and into his living room.
It was like that film, The Ring. He even had his long peroxide blonde hair covering his face like the girl in the film as he crawled into the room. I mean, obviously, I dived behind the sofa as he scuttled towards me. But then I realised that was a mistake, as he had me trapped behind there. I could feel his spectral hand clawing at my behind, trying to pull my pants down.
With a terror-fueled burst of energy, Enkel managed to pull himself away from the apparition and out from behind the sofa.
It came scuttling after me, the sound of static gurgling from his mouth. The only thing I could think of doing was getting the TV and pulling the plug out.
As the TV screen went dead, the ghostly wraith vanished, leaving a terrified Enkel alone in his living room.
I brought up my arm to try and protect myself from my gigantic phallic club swinging toward my head. However, before I could connect, the bizarrely masked figure cried out in pain, dropping the phallus. I looked round to see that Sherlock Holmes, back on his feet, had hurled a set of heavy iron manacles at my assailant. Before I could grab him, the figure had fled through the warehouse's open door. "An African ceremonial leather dildo," observed Holmes, picking up the weapon with which I had so nearly been bludgeoned, "stuffed with water bison testicles. Be a deadly weapon in the right hands, Watson." "But what about the poor fellow?" I asked, gesturing towards the prone figure of the man assaulted by the masked attacker. "Were we too late?" "I'm afraid so, old friend," said Holmes, sadly shaking his head, as he looked down at the blood-stained body. "It seems that someone wanted to ensure that we couldn't speak to Mr. Ephraim Winkler, the proprietor of this emporium." "Then you think we're on the right trail?" I asked. "Indeed, Watson," Holmes replied, turning his attention to an office at the far end of the warehouse. "However, it might be that we managed to disturb this fiend before he had a chance to destroy Winkler's sales records. We might yet be able to find out where the statues originated from." The office was a shambles. Furniture overturned, drawers and filing cabinets ransacked, and, most ominously, the fireplace was full of ashes. "They're still warm. It seems we were too late," declared a crestfallen Holmes, poking the still smouldering hearth with his stick. "I'll venture that all of Winkler's purchase records are destroyed." "Perhaps all is not lost, Holmes," I said, as I rummaged through Winkler's drawers. "The purchase records and his supplier list may be gone, but it seems the attacker missed the sales ledger. If nothing else, we should be able to find out just how many of those infernal statues he supplied, and to whom." "Excellent work, Watson. But what's this?" inquired Holmes, his attention drawn to something on the floor. "It appears to be a piece of dog crap, and it's still warm." "I thought I felt something brush past me as we entered the warehouse," I recalled. "He must have had a dog with him." "Good God, man! What are you doing? Have you gone completely insane?" "My dear fellow, this could prove to be a vital clue," responded Holmes, as he picked up the lump of feces, rolling it under his nose like a cigar, before wrapping it in his handkerchief and placing it in his jacket pocket. "You will no doubt recall my treatise on the subject of canine excrement, which I showed
it is possible to identify no less than 70 breeds of dog merely from the smell, texture, and taste of their droppings. If the animal which left this turns out to be of a unique breed, it may be possible to trace the owner through the records of the Kennel Club. Now, Watson, we must return to Baker Street so that I may thoroughly analyse this evidence. Back at Baker Street, Holmes busied himself with his scientific apparatus, subjecting the dog feces to a series of tests. First, I sent a telegram to Scotland Yard informing Inspector Lestrade of the latest developments. Within the hour, the inspector was back in our rooms, which are now filled with an acrid odour and clouds of brown vapour as Holmes continued his experiments. "What is that peculiar odour, Dr. Watson?" he asked, sniffing the air as he entered. "Crap, Inspector," I explained. "No, really, there is a distinct smell in here, if you don't mind me saying so." "Have you made any progress in your investigations, Inspector?" inquired Holmes, his face lit by a strange putrid glow as he hunched over a Bunsen burner, heating up a test tube full of bubbling liquid. "I'm afraid not, Mr. Holmes. We've still not identified the origin of the statues, but your descriptions of the mask worn by Winkler's murderer tallies with those of the mask worn in the statue maimings. The two crimes are obviously linked." "Of course they are, Lestrade. The sales ledger we recovered from the house shows that what Winkler described as homoerotic sculptures were sold to two houses of ill repute other than those already targeted. I propose that you and your men keep the little oldie shop of titillations under surveillance, whilst Watson and I do the same at the second establishment. Logically, the fiend will strike at one of these next, affording us an opportunity to catch him in the act." Holmes broke off, inhaling deeply from the test tube that he'd been eating, coughing violently before gasping, "Incredible! I've been wrong all along. This excrement, it isn't canine at all. It's most definitely human."
But despite your rather unhappy marital experiences, I believe you remain an enthusiastic advocate of relationships across the great divide of life and death.
"Well, John, whilst there might, as they say, be someone out there for everyone, there's always a strong piss of possibility that someone could already be dead. Spiritual dating gives everybody the chance to quite literally find their soulmate."
"And yes, of course, for anyone who hasn't seen your the High Spirits TV show, which you appear, your singles night seance, in which you channel lost souls in search of love to a group of specially invited single viewers, is of course the most popular feature on that TV show these days. I mean, it has been condemned by the church, of course, who claim it promotes necrophilia. What do you say to that?"
"Oh, absolute nonsense, John. I mean, many of the participants kind of found true love through my singles night seances. I mean, there's a young sewage worker called Tom Wigenfeld recently. He said who could never get on with live women, apparently, but and yet we recently managed to. He recently became engaged to the spirit of Mary Coleshovel, a scullery maid who died in 1874, and we got them together in the seance. I mean, he's ecstatic. I mean, you know, he was telling me the other day how Mary is just so much better than any of the live women he ever met. I mean, he told me that he just felt that live women were too demanding, expecting him to change his underwear every day and not bring his work home, whereas his ghost girlfriend is far more accommodating. Doesn't expect to be taken out anywhere, doesn't have to be bought flowers apart from the odd wreath for a grave, and has no use for expensive clothes and jewellery. And best of all, as far as he's concerned, she only comes when she's summoned, and doesn't complain about the state of his flat or even when he farts in bed. What more could a man want?"
"Y- Yes, but there was controversy last year when there was that tragedy when a female participant in your seance has committed suicide so as to join her lover on the other side. And indeed, in view of the revelations in your book about your own extramarital affairs and relationship difficulties, I mean, isn't there a risk that even your most devoted viewers will start questioning whether you're in a position to be advocating relationships across the spiritual realm? I mean, you can't even keep your own supernatural union together? And not like only that, surely the admission that a spirit can't fulfill the physical side of a marriage is likely to be very damaging. Who wants to be hitched for all eternity to a spook who can't give you the willies, so to speak?
Well, John, I don't claim to be a role model. I don't set myself up as that. I mean, I think we all agree. We can, all of us have at times made mistakes in our relationships. And I do have to say, for the record, I do think my former poltergeist husband's reaction to learning of my various dalliances with spectres, elementals and zombies, even during our marriage, was a gross overreaction when he found out about it on that episode of the Jeremy Kyle show, I Sleep With Dead People. I mean, you know, forming the words cheating bitch in blood on the studio floor, I think it was just going too far. Let alone all those loud knocking noises and furniture flying about. I mean, you know, trust. I think people should take it on trust that most spiritual marriages are far calmer. The mistake in my case was in marrying a poltergeist. Trust me, most other spirits are far quieter and are unlikely to object quite so violently if they catch you being sucked off by a vampire.
Yes. Well, thank you there, Brenda Spadger. Next up, we're having holding our weekly seance, this time to see if we can raise the spirit of notorious sex offender Jimmy Savile.
Our investigations have uncovered several variations on the Savile game, including Ouija board seances at which Savile's catchphrase, now then, is spelt out before an ectoplasmic Jimmy Savile appears to molest the participants. Some versions substitute other celebrity sex offenders for Savile, not all of whom are dead. Indeed, 21-year-old Sally Albo told us of how she tried to invoke Dave Lee Travis.
Well, I'd heard that if you said Dave Lee Travis' name five times in front of a mirror, like, he'd appear in the mirror, reach out and grope your breasts. I mean, I thought it was a bloody stupid idea. As he isn't dead, he's not even in prison. Well, so I decided to disprove it by uttering his name whilst I sat in front of the dressing table mirror in my bedroom.
Not surprisingly, the former Radio 1 DJ, convicted of groping a TV researcher in the 1970s, didn't leap from the mirror to fondle Elbow's breasts.
But just after I said his name for the last time, I felt someone or something touch my bum. I span around, but there's no one else in the room. At the same time as the touch, I'm sure I felt something hairy, like a beard brush the back of my neck. I also noticed the faint odour of cheap aftershave lingering in there after the incident.
It should come as no surprise that so many young people are seizing upon Jimmy Savile as a new personification of evil. Thanks to the media's coverage of his alleged crimes, he's become a modern-day bogeyman. And if you don't believe us, just look at the number of Jimmy Savile Halloween costumes being sold to trick-or-treaters this year. You could hear the hoofbeats pound as they raced across the ground, and the clatter of the wheels as they spun round and round. And he galloped into Market Street, his badge upon his chest. His name was Ernie, and he drove the fastest milk cart in the West. Now Ernie loved a widow, a lady known as Sue. She lived all alone in Lidley Lane at number 22. They said she was too good for him. She was haughty, proud and chic. But Ernie got his cocoa there 3 times every week. She said she'd like to bathe in milk. He said, all right, sweetheart. And when he'd finished work one night, he loaded up his cart. He said, do you want it pasteurized? Because pasteurized is best. She says, Ernie, I'll be happy. It comes up to my chest. Now, Ernie had a rival, an evil-looking man, called Two-Ton Ted from Teddington, and he drove the baker's van. He tempted her with his treacle tarts and his tasty wholemeal bread. But when she's seen the size of his hot meat pies, it very nearly turned her head. She nearly swooned at his macaroon, and he said, if you treat me right, you'll have hot rolls every morning and crumpets every night. He knew once she sampled his layer cake, he'd have his wicked way, and all Ernie had to offer was a pint of milk a day. One lunchtime, Ted saw Ernie's horse and cart outside her door. It drove him mad to find it was still there at 4:30. And as he leapt down from his van, hot blood through his veins did course. And he went across to Ernie's cart and didn't half kick his horse. Now Ernie rushed out into the street, his gold top in his hand. He said, if you want to marry Susie, you'll fight for her like a man. Oh, why don't we play cards for her? He sneeringly replied. And just to make it interesting, we'll have a shilling on the side. Now Ernie dragged him from his van, and beneath the blazing sun, they stood there face to face, and Ted went for his bun. But Ernie was too quick. Things didn't go the way Ted planned. And a strawberry-flavored yogurt sent it spinning from his hand. Now Susie ran between them and tried to keep them apart. And Ernie, he pushed her aside, and a rock cake caught him underneath his heart. And he looked up in pained surprise at the concrete-hardened crust of a stale pork pie caught him in the eye, and Ernie bit the dust. Ernie was only 52. He didn't want to die. And now he's gone to make deliveries in that milk round in the sky. With the customers are angels, and ferocious dogs are banned. And the milkman's life is full of fun in that fairy dairy land. But a woman's needs are manyfold, and soon she married Ted. But strange things happened on their wedding night as they lay in their bed. Was that the trees are rustling? Or the hinges of the gate? Or Ernie's ghostly goat tops are rattling in their crate?